Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
It's hard. It's hard work up there, and it's cold, you know? And so we have very short growing seasons. But I do think that it's more about the collaborations across the system.
That's Amy Trubeck, Associate Professor in Nutrition and Food Science at the University of Vermont. She visited us in the Earth Eats studios to talk about her research with Vermont artisan cheeses and hypothesize why Vermont seems to be the epicenter of the Back to the Land movement. Yael Cassander reports from a cake contest that encourages amateur bakers to create a dessert inspired by architecture. Author Eric Herm waxes lyrical about the poetry of being a farmer, and in the kitchen, two drink recipes with Chef Daniel Orr, the first using strawberries and the second using greens. Anna Coogan is here with our food news headlines.
GMO labeling laws were the biggest newsmakers of the week. Connecticut became the first state in the country to pass a GMO labeling bill. The bipartisan legislation passed both chambers by a landslide, but right-to-know advocates aren't celebrating just yet. Before the law can go into effect, similar legislation in at least four other states, including one that borders Connecticut, must also be passed. Together, those states must have a population of at least 20 million people. 25 other states have considered bills on labeling genetically engineered foods this year. Vermont's labeling bill passed the House by a wide margin and is expected to move to the state Senate when they are back in session next January. Maine is expected to vote on a bill in the next few weeks. And on the West Coast, Washington State residents will be able to vote on a GMO labeling bill in November. The Connecticut law would require food manufacturers to reveal whether their products include genetically engineered ingredients. Staying in New England, Vermont-based ice cream giant Ben & Jerry's announced it hopes to phase out genetically modified ingredients in its products by next year. Ben & Jerry's ice cream sold in the U.S. is already about 80% non-GMO, while in Europe it's 100% GMO-free. And the National Park Service announced new food standards that will require healthy food options at parks around the country. The standards are tied to First Lady Michelle Obama's Let's Move campaign to end childhood obesity. New menu items include bison tenderloin, free-range chicken breast, black bean sliders, sweet potato cakes, and berry yogurt parfaits. A fruit or vegetable will be included with every entree. The guidelines also encourage the use of local, sustainable ingredients. The national parks serve 20 million visitors annually. Follow food news updates all week long by following us on Twitter and Facebook. Find us by searching for Earth Eats.
Thanks for the work this week, Anna.
Happy to do it.
At first glance, the Old House Expo and architectural cake contest seems to be an unlikely pairing. The second annual event in the Bloomington, Indiana City Hall atrium brought amateur bakers and tradespeople out of the woodwork for a day designed to raise awareness about historic preservation. In an attempt to determine what cakes and old houses might have in common, Yael Cassander got to know some of the bakers, builders, and boosters of the local preservation movement.
Let's make this very clear. Eduardo Rhodes does not bake for a living.
Now, do you consider yourself a professional cake maker?
No, absolutely not.
But an avid hobbyist.
Avid hobbyist. Good description.
It's hard to believe because Rhodes, professor emeritus in the School of Public and Environmental Affairs at Indiana University, has arrived with a binder full of photos of cakes he's made for contests, colleagues' retirements, and relatives' weddings.
Actually, I'm working right now on a wedding cake for my niece, which I'll be presenting to her in Philadelphia in about 3 weeks. And that cake is going to involve some unusual flowers, not the classic calla lilies or roses, but orange and cream dahlias, some hydrangeas, some, wax flowers. Anyway, the cake will be baked here and constructed there. So it means I have to make about 20 pounds of frosting, guessing that that's what I'll need, of buttercream, another 15 or so pounds of the roll fondant, which goes over top this. All the flowers will be in nice little boxes for that. I'm actually renting an SUV and then constructed right there on site. I'm about 10 minutes away from the house.
Even though the process appears to be extremely well rehearsed, Rhodes maintains his amateur status.
I do maybe two, maybe three wedding cakes at most a year, as opposed to a professional who might do two or three wedding cakes a week, every week.
Rhodes has managed over the years to pad his portfolio with a dizzying array of baked fantasies, some garlanded with flowers, another bearing a basket of strawberries, one on wheels, and several landscapes.
I have a Mayfire truck.
No, a moving truck.
Right. And we have an igloo. Oh, yeah, there's a very big structure in here somewhere.
Eduardo flips through the pages of his binder.
Oh, yes. A Victory Stadium up in Indianapolis.
Wow, that's gorgeous.
Yeah, I actually got a prize at the state fair for that one.
Nor is that the only prize he's earned for his confectionery constructions. In 2012, Rhodes took the blue ribbon at the inaugural Architectural Cake Contest, a joint effort of the Monroe County Preservation Board of Review and the Bloomington Historic Preservation Commission.
You know, obviously, we're not professional bakers. We've never entered a cake contest before. You know, we're just dealing with a normal-sized kitchen, nothing over the top and fancy, but yet, you know, we're going to see what we come up with.
Amy Payne is one half of a baking duo that's entered the 2013 Architectural Cake Contest. An attorney who works at the Public Defender's Office during the week, Payne has allowed me to watch her weekend adventure in architectural baking. She emphasizes the fact that it was her husband who entered them in the contest.
He had been telling me about this cake contest for quite some time and then, you know, came home one night and was like, guess what? We're making a cake for the contest. I'm like, great. So, yeah, I was more the reluctant party, I guess, to make this cake. So we'll just see what happens.
And that said, Amy has been insistent all along that this cake, first and foremost, tastes good.
Yeah. Amy's husband, Chase Martin, an instructional designer, sits on the Monroe County Historic Preservation Board of Review, one of the contest sponsors.
We have no idea what it's going to look like, but as long as it tastes good, that should be some points, right?
Indeed, according to the contest rules, the cakes would be judged on overall appearance, taste, and faithfulness of representation. As for what could be represented, this year's contest was open to any object or building at least 50 years old, which made the choice obvious for Amy and Chase.
Our theme is going to be history starts at home. And we're actually really excited because we're buying our first house here. And we are going to do a replica of the new limestone ranch that we will be buying. It's built in the 1960s.
Okay, so that's the cake portion.
Should we start the icing?
And now we've just got the icing to get ready while the cakes are baking. So do you want to grab that and I'll get rid of that?
The chocolate loaf cakes are baking while the couple is trying to come up with ways to replicate the limestone exterior of their new home.
We are going to have to try to make gray icing, which I don't know if anybody has seen the movie Steel Magnolias, but there's a big joke in Steel Magnolias about making, how do you make gray icing? So that's what we're going to be trying to do.
Are you going for accuracy of representation?
There's a balance, I think, that we have to hit.
Yeah, there is.
Because if you have a boring looking gray cake, that might not be the most appetizing thing. Yeah.
Yeah, so I think that's
we got to find a nice place in the middle. Yeah. If it doesn't work out, it's cake. And that's the lovely part about cake is
you can eat it.
Yeah. Even if it looks bad.
You know, our meetings, like most board and commission meetings, tend to go on a bit sometimes.
Nancy Hiller is the chair of the County Preservation Board and the Cake Committee.
And sometimes it's the middle of winter and the air in the meeting room is stuffy and dry and you're really ready to quit. And actually you get sort of punch drunk just because you're tired. And so it was on one of those occasions when we were throwing around ideas for some kind of event that would celebrate historic preservation and increase awareness. And I said, how about cakes? How about cakes made in the shape of old houses?
In addition to Chase and Amy's limestone ranch, there's a cake representing a downtown storefront, a brick filling station, an iron truss bridge, and a landscape destroyed by I-69 construction. Everyone's a winner in the contest, including Amy and Chase.
We won the best mid-century modern.
Is that a tough part of the competition to make this amazing thing that you get a little attached to, I would imagine, and then have it eaten?
No, at least for me it isn't.
Eduardo Rhodes is the avid hobbyist who won last year's contest with his Bryan House cake.
People always ask me that. Don't you feel bad? The purpose of the cake is to be consumed, have fun. People, I just couldn't cut it. Sure you do. You just go, that's it. It's cut. And the nice thing about a cake is that, other than pictures, when it's over, it's over. It's gone.
By early afternoon, most of the cake is gone, the demolished remains getting scooped up and carted off to the community kitchen. The craftsmen at the Old House Expo are packing up, headed back to the old houses they're trying to keep vertical.
Because it took so long to bake it, and I'll never find that recipe again.
For WFIU, I'm Yael Cassander.
You can see pictures of the prize-winning cakes, along with some behind-the-scenes shots in the kitchen, on the website eartheats.org. Amy Trubeck studied cooking at Le Cordon Bleu Cooking School, but she decided that 60 to 80 hours a week in front of a hot stove just wasn't for her. So instead of cooking food, she decided to study it. Trubeck is an associate professor in nutrition and food science at the University of Vermont. She visited students at Indiana University's Food Studies program to talk about her research with Vermont maple syrup and artisan cheeses. She collaborated with various producers in the state to understand the importance of social relations to people's sensory experiences of food.
Sort of when I say social experience is sensory experience is social experience, that you're the when you taste food and you say, wow, I really like this cheese. A lot of what makes you have a sense of preference for that cheese comes from your social experiences. So how your community or your natural environment are shaping your actual sensory moment.
Isn't part of the problem then with our food system these days is that a lot of people don't see eating as a social or cultural experience. They're eating in their cars as they're going to or from places. I mean, is that the big problem?
I think that, yes, we don't pay enough attention in general to the sensory experience. I think there are other cultures where social dialogue about, well, what do you think about this food? Why do you think this is good? You know, when you're either within your family or in a kind of a communal setting, yes, I think we pay less attention. I would say that I don't think that particularly in the traditional European puritanical food culture of the United States, you were ever supposed to pay attention. So I would not blame it exactly on eating in your car, but I don't think eating in your car is any help.
Well, let's talk about your book, The Taste of Place, A Cultural Journey into Terroir. What is terroir? Define that for me.
Terroir is a French term that I actually translated as the taste of place, as the way that I thought I could best explain what it is. And a lot of what I talk about in the book is, in fact, because I do research and researchers like things to be complicated. So it's, in fact, an untranslatable term. So – and one of the reasons it's untranslatable is because it's so much about the context of France and what they value in France. But for the American audience, I will say that it is really about the relationship of people in a natural environment and the food that it's made in that relationship between people and a certain natural environment. And it's about the taste, what you can say about how that food tastes and how you can say that that food tastes a certain way because of where it comes from or because of who made it or both. So what the book does is it starts in France and it says, okay, what happens in France? Why is terroir a notion that is considered to be a viable way of explaining what makes you like something and what makes food or drink taste good? In the United States, particularly in the last 30 years or so, the concept of terroir has increasingly become part of the lexicon of people who I call taste producers, so people that are in the work of making food of quality. So winemakers, cheesemakers, chefs, you know, bread makers. There's tons of people that are doing this kind of artisan work now who are very committed to what makes it good, and they oftentimes use recourse to a concept of terroir.
Let's highlight Vermont specifically then. Vermont is a leader in this locavore movement. Vermont was ranked number one in the locavore index recently. So is there something about the culture of Vermont that make it more accessible for people to do this sort of thing?
Well, I think a lot of other places have a lot more potential because they actually have way better land. So, you know, if people would figure out what we were doing and just did it in other places that are not so almost impossible, they're going to do way, you know, I shouldn't be saying this. This is not the artisan cheesemakers of Vermont are not going to be pleased with me if I say this. But, you know, it's hard. It's hard work up there and it's cold, you know. Mm-hmm. And so we have very short growing seasons. But I do think that it's more about the collaborations across the system. Everybody knows everybody in Vermont. We only have 660,000 people in the entire state.
Wow.
So it's like one big small town. And then we have we're very politically progressive as a state now. I will say, I mean that in two senses of the term, that we have been consistently voting in what it could be understood as liberal politicians, but we also have citizen-based democracy with town meeting and small-scale interface. So I think that the most important thing to know about Vermont is the citizen democracy part, because I think it makes for a sense of we can make things happen here and we can do it in a community that is very persistent in the state.
Well, we've been doing a lot of talking about taste, so put on your chef hat for the moment. We're going to do a little exercise right now. Think of your favorite cheese, mm-hmm. whatever that is. Give me chef talk mm-hmm. about how it tastes. So we could put, you know, another sense into this conversation.
So there's a cheese that's being made in Vermont that is based on actually a English model, which is called cloth-bound cheddar. So cheddar is a very quintessential, sort of understood as a quintessential American cheese in a way, and it's made a lot in New England, and also Wisconsin is very well known for its cheddar. But it has been traditionally just the cheddaring process has then stopped, and then you age the cheese simply like that. But in a cloth-bound cheddar, you actually brush the cheese with lard, and then you encase it in cloth, and then you put and then you let natural molds ripen on it, and then you age it for a long time. You have that texture of a cheddar where there's a kind of a crumbliness to it, but it has a slightly nutty flavor and also a little bit of what we call caramel. It's just amazing. It's a lovely cheese.
Nice. Amy Trubeck is an associate professor in the Nutrition and Food Science Department at the University of Vermont. She teaches courses in the contemporary food system, food and culture, and food history, and has by far the coolest research of anybody that I've spoken with for Earth Eats. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
She recommends serving that cloth-bound cheddar in a salad with some apples. Read my complete conversation with Amy Trubeck at eartheats.org. Coming up, Chef Daniel Orr is whipping up a breakfast smoothie.
We're using the silken tofu, and that's going to give you a nice protein source in the morning, and it's also going to keep you from getting a sugar rush.
Don't worry, we're going to add some strawberries to that tofu to make it delicious. Join us in the kitchen in just a few moments. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, therapeutic massage, and Hatha Yoga, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. Memberships and gift certificates available. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com.
Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Every week we speak with authors who've written everything from cookbooks to food history books, and we feature snippets of those interviews here on the program. Our book today is Surviving Ourselves by Eric Herm.
Most farmers aren't poets or don't write poetry, I would imagine.
Herm was raised on a cotton farm in Ackerley, Texas. He left the family farm to pursue other things and then returned later in life. For him, writing is an expression of the relationship he has with the land.
I think that poetry is really a language of the soul, of spirit, of nature. You know, nature, there's poetry in nature every time you walk outside.
Here's 1 minute with farmer and author Eric Herm.
You know, everything needs the other in order to survive and to complete itself. It took me a long time to realize that. I didn't realize it when I was growing up on the farm. I had to leave and come back to realize that strong connection, that bond that exists between the earth and an individual, another creature. You know, for me, when you're a kid, you know, you don't really have the maturity, or at least I didn't, to fully appreciate what I had here. It was just a lot of work to me. You know, most of my friends were out having fun in the summer times, and it was not. It was pure labor for me. May through July, the end of July, was the hardest time of the year for me physically and emotionally. And I think that I was just unable to see through that hard work, the physical labor, and, you know, not allowing that connection to happen that I speak of nowadays. Leaving and doing different jobs in the world and seeing different cultures and different people through traveling and just living life in general, you're able to appreciate that a lot more. You know, it's only really through nature, through the farm, through these plants, through the rain that I'm really able to complete myself.
Read more about Eric Herm and his book Surviving Ourselves on his website, sonofafarmer.com. We got into a conversation on our Twitter feed earlier this week about where to go pick your own berries this time of year. If you're in southern Indiana, Huber Winery is a good choice. We found that info and plenty of other pick-your-own farms listed by state on the website pickyourown.org. So in honor of strawberry season, our first recipe is for a fruit smoothie.
Very good way to start the day. We've got some strawberries. You could use whatever kind of fruit you want. I mean, if Indiana grows great melon, so you could do something that I call a Scoopy-Doo. It's a honeydew smoothie.
That sounds great.
Okay, we also have, this is a silken strawberry smoothie today. So we're using the silken tofu, and that's going to give you a nice protein source in the morning, and it's also going to keep you from getting a sugar rush. Because the fresh fruit, if you ate it on its own without any protein, it would give you more of kind of a fructose sugar rush. And throwing that in, we've got some orange juice, about a cup and a half. We're going to add about a cup and a half of ice. I'm going to add a little bit of lime juice, give a little bit of acidity. And we're just going to let that rock. So breakfast is easy to make, is that? Okay, the hardest part of it is cleaning up the blender. Have a little taste.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Taste as you go is one of Chef Orr's rules to live by in the kitchen. It will be easy to do in our next recipe. This one goes out to all our Twitter followers who requested juice recipes a while back. This is a green juice, thanks to the kale, parsley, and spinach we're mixing in. But if you want more sweetness, add some extra pineapple, maybe another carrot. Or if you need to add more acid, add some orange juice. Taste and adjust as you go. Just use this recipe as a jumping-off point.
What you need to really remember is to balance your sweet and your kind of more savory vegetables. You don't want to have a whole lot of just sugar in your juices. But you don't want to have something that's real bitter and you don't like. So the whole thing is about balancing those different flavors. And you can really just go to the green market or to your local farmer's market and pick up whatever looks really, really fresh and then supplement it with some more traditional items from the regular grocery store.
Kale is making itself known at the farmer's market these days, so that's the first ingredient that goes in the juicer.
And so we're going to start with that, and I usually start with my vegetables that are a little coarser or drier,
And then I push through the more moisture-full items like the cucumber and celery and things like that afterwards, so I'm sure to extract all the flavor and juices out of the drier vegetables. So we're going to put our kale in. I'm just going to push it down with the cucumber as my press. And I'm going to push another couple different types of kale. I've got some Tuscan kale, I've got some purple kale, as well as the more traditional curly green kale. And you don't want to put too much in your juicer at one time, because then it just gets unmanageable and you'll have to clean it out every time you put a new vegetable in.
So I'm looking at this. On one side we have some juice coming out, some green goo, and on the other side it looks like leftover bits from the kale.
Right, and it's very, very dry and powdery. You can actually use some of those dried out pieces of vegetable in things like soups or stocks if you'd like, so you don't have to waste that. Next I'm going to add another flavoring, which is some ginger, and ginger is really great if you got a sore throat or not feeling that great. And some carrot. Carrot's going to give you a bit of sweetness.
So slowly but surely we're getting juice.
Smell that ginger. And when you put that ginger through, let's see if you can smell that.
The predominant smell is the kale at this point.
The kale, yeah. Okay, and we're going to add just a touch of sweetness with some pineapple. And that's going to be what makes it taste good. And then you can throw whatever you want in. I've got some baby spinach, I've got some parsley, all those good green things.
So you're really telling me that this is going to taste good.
Well, I like it. You know, there is the one thing that if it makes you feel good and is healthy, then that should make it taste better too. Okay, and then I'm just going to finish by pushing the cucumber through, and that's going to give us our volume. I'm going to finish it with a little bit of what I call my citrus trio, and that's just a little bit of lemon juice, lime juice, and orange juice. And that's going to give it a little bit of acidity, that nice orange flavor. Give it a little taste. Well, I think you're going to be pleasantly surprised. All right, we'll have a taste.
Cheers, everybody.
Santé.
Find recipes of all kinds using seasonal ingredients on our website, author interviews, archived podcasts, news articles. We're covering all angles of the sustainable food world at eartheats.org. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Ben Alford, Aabon Binder, Eric Herm, Luann Johnson, Yael Cassander, Chef Daniel Orr, Amy Trubeck, and a special thanks to James Gray, who produced today's show. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, therapeutic massage, and Hatha Yoga, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. Memberships and gift certificates available. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. We always appreciate you tuning in. Enjoy a great week of eating. For Earth Eats, I'm Annie Corrigan.